Okay, we might as well kick off just to welcome everybody to the latest Whitaker Ideas Forum. So we're very happy today to welcome Pip Dorsey from the Technology and Governance Research Cluster. And Pip is going to talk to us about a critique of linguistic capitalism and artistic intervention. So we're very much looking forward to it.
Thank you very much. Thanks everyone for coming. So, yes, I'm Pip Thornton. I'm a PhD candidate at Royal Holloway at the University of London, where I'm researching my thesis, which is called Language in the Age of Algorithmic Reproduction. I've been here at NUIG since September last year, working as a research assistant to John Danaher's Algocracy and Transhumanism project. So John has asked me to present some of my research as part of the Technology and Governance Whitaker Institute Ideas Forum. And luckily, it fits quite well, I think, with that, but perhaps from a different angle as from other talks, perhaps. So I'm going to start off with a little bit about my background. So my PhD is co-supervised between cybersecurity and the geography or geopolitics department. But my academic background is actually in English literature. So my thesis is a mixture of these disciplines. Primarily, I'm interested in how language flows through digital spaces, how it is increasingly mediated and manipulated by large technology companies that dominate the internet, in particular Google and its advertising strategies, which will be the focus of this talk. Of course, advertising is not a new thing, and nor is the making of money from words, but my argument is that the way language is commodified in today's digital infrastructure has consequences far beyond those of print capitalism or the advent of mass media and marketing in the 20th century. And these consequences are both linguistic, i.e. how language is targeted towards or even written by algorithms and computerized systems, which I look at through search engine optimization and keyword advertising, but also political. I think there's been a shift in the value of language from what we might call its linguistic function as a conveyor of narrative information, be that as a piece of news, which could be fake, an email header, which could be spam, or even creative language, such as poetry, which is often so non-normative that it gets stopped by firewalls and antivirus software. And this shift is towards the economic value and use of language, which is separated from its linguistic function. And when language is used primarily as a tool with which to pursue other purposes, or as a vessel on which to piggyback data through the various material intricacies and obstructions of the web, often, as I'll be talking about, with the prime purpose of creating capital, the linguistic side effects, or the collateral damage to words which are cast aside once they've served their economic purpose, can be huge and politically devastating, as we've seen in the build-up to the US election and the proliferation of so-called fake news and misinformation. So in this talk, I'm going to start with an overview of what I mean by linguistic capitalism. And I'm going to illustrate this with examples from some of the array of tools and platforms which are provided by Google, allegedly for free, such as Google Search, AdWords, AdSense, AdGrants, and Gmail. I'm using Google specifically because of its sheer ubiquity and reach. Google has a 95% market share of search, for example. But also because I believe that this ubiquity and reach, facilitated by the systemic anomalies of an algorithmically mediated flow of information, the embedded digital economy within those systems, and the dominance of their owners, i.e. the tech companies, translates into what is a frightening power over media, politics, language, and the wider discourse. This is a form of governance in itself, and is therefore in need of both a strong critique and transparency, which are of course difficult to achieve when the processes involved are closely guarded trade secrets, such as Google's black box algorithms. So in the second half of the talk, I'm going to start thinking about what can be done to critique, or to resist, or even to make visible the workings of linguistic capitalism. I'll use a couple of examples of artistic and political interventions, and also explain my own intervention, which is a project called Poem.py, which in its own way tries to make visible the changing value of language in an age of linguistic capitalism, using Google AdWords, poetry, and a second-hand receipt printer. So first of all, I'm going to very, very briefly show you why I became interested in how language is being affected by digital and algorithmic mediation and reproduction. So my original PhD thesis wasn't about this at all, it was about military geographies, and very quickly I was at a briefing at a kind of military think tank in London, and all these old colonels and generals were referring to friends and family of military personnel as wives and girlfriends in this kind of quite derogatory way, which really irritated me. I was in the military myself, and it's a phrase, sort of, it's very culturally loaded in terms of footballers' wives and whatever. So I went away and I searched this in Google. So wives and girlfriends, is it a sexist statement? Has anyone written about a sexist phrase? Has anyone written about this before? And I was really, really surprised when these are the results that came back. So as you can see, I hope everyone can see from there. On the face of it, Google's just changed the word sexist to sexiest. So it's kind of made the assumption that that's what I was meant to be, I was searching for. So it's given me the most commercially viable result, really. Or maybe it's a result of an error, sort of compounded over the years through algorithmic tweaks or what have you. Certainly, what interested me was that, in effect, not only had an algorithm decided on my behalf what I had meant to search for, and had provided me with the most commercially popular result, but that the words wives and girlfriends had become inextricably linked to the word sexiest rather than sexist in the sort of wider corpora of data. And there are numerous other examples of sexist or racist results in Google search, especially in autocomplete, which I don't have time to show you here. It seems that the words and phrases which flow through search engines have to some extent developed semantic escorts, which compound stereotypes, and from which they are unlikely ever to be able to break free. And it was doing some research around this subject when I first came across the concept of linguistic capitalism in the work of the theorist Frederick Kaplan. Kaplan used the term specifically in relation to Google's advertising platform, AdWords. So AdWords, as a lot of you probably already know, it's where Google earns the bulk of its money, and it's why Google as a company is so successful today. And the idea is really, really simple, which is what makes it so clever. If you want to guarantee your website a place right at the top of the search engine rankings, you have to pay to advertise on Google. And this means you have to bid for the words you feel will attract the most traffic to your advert and to your site. So every time someone searches for your keyword, a mini auction takes place. And if you are the highest bidder at that particular moment, then you win the auction and your advert is displayed above the organic results on the results page. Every time someone clicks on your advert, you then pay Google the price of the winning bid. So more clicks means you pay Google more, but you also have more traffic to your site, which hopefully generates sales. This whole process creates a strange world in which words have a value in a way curiously abstracted and sometimes seemingly disproportionate to their usual ranking of importance or relevance in everyday language and life. They have quite literally been auctioned off for their exchange value. So this is in effect a linguistic marketplace where the monetary value of a word relates directly to the amount of money advertisers think they could make from it, rather than any other intrinsic value a word might have. This in turn affects what words are used in advertising copy and also in the texts which make up the digital corpus of language on the web. For example, the keyword planner which Google provides to suggest opening bid prices, and I'll talk about that later, also helps people who are not paying for advertising to choose which words and phrases are more likely to be picked up by the search algorithms, which might elevate their company, their product, or their political viewpoint to the top of the organic search results. But crucial to this is that words are being written primarily for the consumption of algorithms rather than humans. Language, in this way, is being used in a distinctly different way. Now, if we look at linguistic capitalism in this way, it might be possible to argue that this doesn't really matter. It's just an ingenious money-making scheme by Google and has no effect in the wider world. In fact, the last time I gave a version of this talk, one of the comments at the end defended the way AdWords works in a Hayekian way, that a market of words is merely producing the knowledge and wisdom needed for the efficient distribution of goods. And I think that's a really interesting point. The knowledge produced by a linguistic marketplace is really interesting. And it's an ongoing project of mine, which I won't be able to fit into my PhD, whereby I'm collecting price data over 1,000 words every day in different geographical regions to see how it's affected by, or maybe how it affects, major cultural or political world events. But what I think is equally as interesting is that the Hayek wisdom of markets argument only stacks up if the linguistic marketplace were to be seen as a free market based on unhindered competition, rather than the centrally planned and monopoly-controlled way Google oversees the market, setting lowest bid prices and censoring certain words, for example, or letting certain organisations have free advertising, which brings me on to the next section, which is about Google ad grants. Now, this is an area that I've just recently started researching. So ad grants is another free Google tool, and it lets charities and NGOs use up to $10,000 worth of AdWord advertising every month for free. Now this is an in-kind grant, i.e. Google doesn't actually give the cash away, but lets groups use the AdWords service for free, which enables small, not-for-profit groups to enter the market, to raise their profiles and hopefully attract support and donations. Their successful adverts appear on the top of the search results page, just like the commercial paid-for adverts, although their bids are capped at $2 a click. Google frames its ad grants project as a philanthropic enterprise, and on the face of it, it does allow small charities to increase their reach and audience. But what interests me is the scale of this project and the potential for political and linguistic distortion it could be having. It's hard to know exact figures, but the ad grant scheme facilitates millions and millions of dollars and pounds of free advertising to hundreds of thousands of organisations every year all over the world. As I mentioned before, the wording is misleading here. These donations from Google are in kind, so Google's not providing cash up front, yet it gets to record ad grant revenues as charitable donations with the considerable tax breaks this entails. The other interesting thing about Google ad grant scheme is its recent shift into politics. When it was first launched, any adverts with political or religious messages were banned, but Google quietly did away with that clause on their terms and conditions page sometime last year, when it started to allow organisations to use ad grants to try to counter political and religious extremism. The most prominent example of this counter-extremist campaign was launched last year, and it was called the Redirect Method, a blueprint for bypassing extremism. So this method is run under the auspices of Google's Jigsaw Ideas Wing, and it aims to counter extremism by redirecting searches for certain trigger words. For example, jihad or join ISIS, or there's hundreds more. And what they do is they divert those searches to specially curated content which aims to educate would-be extremists and provide a balanced view. This includes hours of YouTube footage from Syria and other ISIS-held territories. Now, cynically minded people like me would know that Google owns YouTube, so technically benefits from this traffic. There's all kinds of other problems that I can see in this setup. So what does this matter? Surely to oppose Google funding the promotion of worthy charities, fundraisers and NGOs would be uncharitable. And isn't it good that Google are trying to counter extremist material in its search engine? Google have used the same kind of redirection method for people searching for suicide techniques for years, sending them to helplines. Well, I haven't quite decided what the answer to that question is yet, but the decision to allow this type of advertising was partly as a result of government pressure for Google to be responsible for the content it spreads. But it's also opened the door to thousands of somewhat shadowy, borderline charity status organisations to utilise the free advertising too, thereby potentially influencing the search results with what is in effect Google-sponsored political and religious rhetoric. Now, anyone can apply for this funding. You'd have to set up a charity, but wouldn't necessarily need to be a sort of traditional charity. It could be a think tank. They have charity status. Or the philanthropic branch of a large corporation would also have that status to allow them to use these free words. So, and as anyone can apply for this, it's meant that organisations who might be viewed as extremists themselves have already used and have been removed from the campaign. And the adverts which it funds are often extremely confusing in their message. Now, I did a search for Join ISIS with a VPN and my webcam covered, obviously. And these were the adverts that were served to me. So you see here, the middle two are kind of doing their job. So I've searched for Join ISIS, and these are the free adverts that charities or organisations have used. You've got counterextremism.com, read expert report on extremism in Syria, looking to join ISIL, decide what the reality is. Then you've got these things up here, so ISIS is the crisis, free ISIS, national tour, book now, really sort of confusing in their message. They're not, what is this tour? Is it a commercial thing that's hiding under the sort of banner of this free advertising? Don't know. But to me, this is the most worrying one. Convert to Islam. Now, I don't know. I find the sort of political message. The political message in that is it potentially elevates it to a degree, or the religious message of it, to a degree you wouldn't have if you weren't benefiting from this free advertising. So, but another thing that struck me about this redirect method is the clinical efficiency and market-based logic with which it thinks it can solve the problem of online extremism. And the whole thing, especially for me, the title sounds a bit 1984 or Clockwork Orange, this kind of unaccountable people trying to manipulate what you search for or what you think. But there are detailed and glossy manuals telling anyone how they can use this free advertising to redirect people's views and search queries. Here's a couple of quotes that, from one of those manuals. We're using the same tactic that businesses use to advertise to consumers, the same way a shoe company might serve ads against the keywords running or jogging. Well, this method fuels a $1 trillion e-commerce sector. It's hardly been used as a tool to provide alternative messages to people who are looking for extremist content online. Now, to me, that's a really startling kind of neoliberal logic running through this type of explanation, which I'll come back to in the conclusion, hopefully. So moving on now from AdWords to another Google advertising platform, Google AdSense, and its role in the fake news debate. So the New York Times last week reported the story of an American college graduate who needed money to pay off his loans, and how he fabricated and published a fake news story, which went viral and earned him thousands of dollars of ad revenue from Google. The story he made up was that before the US elections, tens of thousands of already filled in pro-Clinton ballot papers had been discovered in a warehouse in Chicago. And he did this on the back of some of the rhetoric that Donald Trump had been spouting about vote rigging at the time, and in the knowledge that it was a story that would spread across the internet like wildfire. Sometime before this, he had bought a second-hand domain name and he'd created his own fake news site, which he'd given the reputable name of the Christian Times newspaper. And he tested out a number of fake stories before he sort of hit the jackpot on the ballot box story. So this is his website, and this is the story. I mean, it looks fairly reputable. But then he made up a story around this, which he completed with fake quotes from this fake warehouse worker, who had supposedly found these fraudulent ballots, very helpfully labelled ballot box. But what came out in the New York Times story is that this photograph was actually taken in 2015 in a small outside a community centre in Birmingham in the UK. And this is just off Google Images, basically. But he's used it, and it's breaking. It's a good story. It's reputable. It's a religious Christian thing. But although the guy that did this, he did identify as a Republican, but he admitted to the New York Times that politics wasn't his primary objective. He knew that with every visit to his website, he earned money from the Google Ads displayed on it. That's how Google AdSense works. You submit your website to Google, and you get paid for every time Google are able to serve an advert on it. The advertiser pays Google, and Google pays a small amount to the website hosts and keeps the difference. In order to generate clicks to his site, he used Facebook as a means to spread the story, which then gained traction amongst Trump supporters. And it spread through Facebook through likes, comments, and shares, eventually reaching an estimated 6 million people. Now, this is a website that he bought for $5, the domain. By this method, the link clicks to his website from the Facebook generation, and the resulting advert served to its visitors by Google. It earned him over $20,000 in a few weeks. Furthermore, the popularity of his website and its revenue-earning potential, which, like I say, he bought for $5 and which made up purely of fake news stories, gave it a resale value of $100,000, which he failed to cash in on, unfortunately. Google pulled the ad before he could sell the site. Obviously, some of what is now being called fake news does have political motives. We can think of maybe the Trump dossier, historically propaganda campaigns or psyops. But in today's world, the value of information, or truth, or facts can be completely detached from what the words actually say, i.e. the value is purely financial. But again, this is not a new thing. We've all seen clickbait headlines which try to get you to a site. You think, Karl Marx ate my hamster, or you'll never guess what such and such a celebrity looks like now, 25 years later. This type of thing. But when the so-called information changes from celebrity gossip to the campaign trail, then the political fallout becomes a very dangerous byproduct. So a quote from the article, "The ads are real, but the news is fake." And not all misinformation spread unwittingly by Google advertising before the US election was homegrown. Last summer, The Guardian reported how a small town in Macedonia had become a pro-Trump fake news factory. Teenagers in the town had realised how much money they could make from Google AdSense and set about creating websites with sensationalist content that they knew would spread. Unfortunately for the Clinton campaign, the stories which generated most traffic and most links, and thereby kind of infecting the rest of the news content on the web, were full of pro-Trump right-wing propaganda. So the important thing about these examples is they illustrate the disconnect between the value of the words which make up these dodgy websites and the value they accrue through the adverts they bear. So that's the first part of my paper. I'm going to have to go off piece now. I haven't got anything else written down. So now I want to talk about some interventions. And I'm going to use three examples. So the first example, going back to what we just talked about Google AdSense, is a Twitter campaign by a Twitter group called Sleeping Giants. The second one is possibly my favourite intervention into the whole Google enterprise, which is it's about the novel American Psycho and Gmail. And thirdly, I'm then going to explain my own artistic intervention, which is this, the Poem.py project. And for that, I'll be helped by Lutan Higgins, who's very kindly turned up today. So, back to AdSense. This is Breitbart, which is an alt-right news group that supported the Trump campaign. It's known for its racist and its sexist views. And this is one of their sort of top stories. And notice the advert here for Hyundai. Hyundai buying sort of advertising packages. They don't know where the ads are going to be placed. That's the next one. They don't know where the ads are going to be placed. And so what this campaign, the Sleeping Giants campaign, does is to try and make the advertisers aware what their ads are showing next to, basically. So they encourage their followers to take screenshots of things like this and then contact Hyundai and say, look, do you realise that this is where you're advertising against these types of articles? So this is another example. Birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. And there's a kind of very sort of benign Ancestry.com advert next to it. Obviously, they were outraged and quite embarrassed that their ads are showing up in these places. So Sleeping Giants has a sort of manifesto or a kind of guide to what you can do to sort of resist or this sort of phenomenon. So go to Breitbart and take a screenshot of an ad next to some of their content. Tweet the screenshot to the company with a polite message. And then tag it with the handle, tag it to Sleeping Giants, so they can keep track of the progress. And they've managed to get about 1,000, I think, to date, companies to alter their ad packages so that because they don't want to be associated with this type of content. Right. So next example, Gmail and American Psycho. Now I don't know if anyone's read the book American Psycho. It's an absolutely amazing book, but it's disgusting and horrible, and he tears women to pieces and slices them up, and it's really, really nasty. So, a couple of researchers in the US obviously picked this book because of its controversial content, misogynistic content. And what they did is they sent a page of the book each day through. They created two new Gmail accounts, and they took a page of the book, and each day they sent a page between their Gmail accounts, knowing full well, as we all do, that Gmail algorithmically reads emails that you send for the purpose of targeted advertising, so it's trying to pick up keywords. And so they did this with the whole of the book. And then once they'd done that, as they were doing that, they recorded the adverts that Google were generated by Google in the Gmail account, which come up in the sort of tabs on your Gmail page. They recorded them, and they recorded the page to which they related. And they recreated the book, taking out the text. So here's a sort of three strips of a page. Obviously, the text would have been here. These are kind of the phantom footnotes. If you remember the novel, this page is when Patrick Bateman is boiling the woman's head in the microwave after he's kind of skinned her, I think. And the adverts, the language, this is what this language means to Google. So it's serving these two adverts. 8 easy main course meals. Try lean cuisine. Market creations in a new easy to cook microwave bags. And the second one, this presumably was to do with the skinning or the oil. on sale keratin treatment, up to 45% off keratin treatments. So kind of, you know, is a skin product. So they did this for the whole book, and it's and they recreated it, and they then kind of published it as an artwork with this kind of these phantom adverts. I mean, it's absolutely amazing kind of critique of the whole advertising industry, but also of, yeah, like I say, what, you know, what does AdWords mean to a company like Google? What does it get from it? It gets this from this awfulness that's happening to women, or, you know, if you look at it in that way. So this is, like I said, this is probably my favourite intervention. And it's what inspired me to try and think about looking at an artistic intervention to the work that I'm doing. So I went back to Google AdWords, and I have an English literature background, I love poetry, I love creative writing, and it really bothers me in some kind of probably problematic humanistic way that language is changing this much, or by these kind of algorithmically generated methods. So I went to Google AdWords, and I thought, I looked at the keyword panel, which I mentioned before, which is, if you want to place an advert, let's say you want to place an advert for a fireplace, you go to the keyword panel, you type fireplace in, and it tells you it suggests what your initial bid price would be, so that you can then make an educated guess into how to enter into the auction process to buy that, to win that keyword in the auction so that your advert will be displayed. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically that's what the key plan does. So I thought, what would happen if I took a poem and I fed it through the keyword panel, and I wanted to see how much it was worth to Google? So I did that, and I played around with it, and I thought, oh, this would be really cool if I could kind of make it look like it was coming out on a receipt. Like, you know, Google said, this is how much we charge for your poem. So I did this, which is one of my sort of early efforts. So this is the first few words from William Wordsworth's Daffodils, I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud. On the receipt, what I've done is a date timestamp, as you would on a receipt, and this is relevant because these prices change day to day, and they change in different geographic areas, which hopefully after my PhD I'm going to kind of delve more into this data that I've been gathering about this to try and work out what affects what, with the language affecting, or the language affecting things. So the next thing I did, this is the place where the authentication code would be on a receipt. So what I did is a checksum. Hash value of those words as a block of text. A checksum is a cryptographic formula that kind of travels with an integral piece of data, and it means that you can check that nothing's happened to it on the way. So the person opening it can double check cryptographically to know that piece of text, it's not used for poetry, it's used for sort of, you know, security and mathematics and stuff like that. But it's a kind of play on this. It's trying to say, you know, if it was protected by cryptography, then the integrity of this piece of text would be maintained. But if it's not protected, then it's subject to these laws of the market, which you can't control. So I had to use Python code. I was doing massive long poems, so I had to use some code to reorder the letters, to reorder the words into the right order. And really interesting things started happening when I was doing these things. I was wondering, in this poem, obviously it has the words cloud, it has the words host, and crowd, all in the first stanza. And I was wondering why they were expensive. So cloud is £2.12, and host and crowd are even more expensive. And I realised that they're not expensive because of how William Wordsworth thought, oh, there's a lovely cloud and a host of golden daffodils and things. It's because of cloud computing and web hosting and crowdsourcing, which I thought was really interesting in terms of this kind of stripping language of its context. And so you can't, you know, you do a search for cloud, and Google is making you search for the commercial cloud, not for the Wordsworth cloud. So that's the important context. This is my little dig at Google and its tax situation. So, and so I made this into a little project. Now I used the Python code, obviously, with help. Didn't do it myself, to be honest. I used Python code to sort of reorder these words. So I called the project poem.py. So py is the file extension of Python, so that's the name of the project. And I started experimenting at a couple of talks that I did, sort of asking people in the audience to give me their favourite poem beforehand. And and then I'd sort of, as a performance, I'd print out their poem during it, which, you know, it went down all right. And I did loads of these. I thought I'd start experimenting a bit, and I wondered whether I could experiment with not only what linguistic capitalism might look like in this term that I received from Google, but what it might sound like. And I've been lucky enough since I've been in Galway to have made the acquaintance of Rita Ann Higgins, who's a Galway poet, who, with thanks to Jerry, who was a Galway poet who wrote a poem called Our Killer City, which was as part of the, correct me if I'm wrong, it was part of the bid for the 2020 City of Culture for Galway. And it's really a reverent poem, it's brilliant, and I loved it, and Jerry suggested that I try it out on my with my project, and so I did. And there's loads of really interesting things about the words and the prices in different geographical areas on this poem. But just to get the sort of boring bit out of the way first, what I did is search the poem through all English markets on Google, and it was worth £467.12. I then searched it in Ireland, and it was worth £277.34. And I'm afraid to say, in Galway, Rita's poem is only worth £64.02. Which in itself is interesting, because the words mean different things. They're localised and this kind of thing. So again, it's all interest and all this kind of wisdom that's coming out of it, if you want to think about it in this Hayekian sense. So I wanted to kind of expand this, do a new thing in this talk. So I've asked Rita to read some of the poem, Our Killer City, and so she's going to do that, and then I'm going to present my own interpretation of what Rita Ann's poem, would sound like to Google.
I'm just going to read a little excerpt from the beginning and the end. And I am the winner, really, because City Hall gave me £1,000 for the poem. There was a chance that I would read it to the judging panel, but I was never asked. Anyway, Our Killer City. Always good to win, capital of culture is all. 2020, give the horse plenty. We're in with a great chance until they hear about the Legionnaire's disease outbreak in the fire station, where our lifesavers need saving. Don't mention local artists at all. Let it be like they don't exist. Raise the rents is the best way to keep the ripped jeans gang out, like it's always been. Artists may arse. This is Galway, the bidding city, the forbidding city. City of thieves, or is it scribes, or is it tribes? The jury are coming this July. The word is out, they'll rule on the bid for capital of culture. 2020, give the horse plenty. We have a great little city here, a pity little city, a shitty little city.
Thanks, Rita Ann. So, I haven't quite finished. You've got a conclusion to come yet, only a short one. What I wanted to do is to kind of counter what you've just done, this reading out of your poem. So this is my sort of imagining about what Google hears when Rita Ann reads her poem.
Ka-ching.
I think this is only a £64 version.
I'm cheap.
Oh, I might be wrong. There you go. Thanks very much.
So I've just got just a couple of conclusions. I haven't really fleshed out, but we'll see how it goes. So my first conclusion is, this has been bandied around in the press in the last couple of weeks, is what we're experiencing with this whole sort of this fake news phenomenon. Is it just a kind of manifestation of what people like Jameson or Lyotard called the postmodern condition, this kind of decoupling of facts from or signs and signifiers in a kind of post-structuralist way. Is that what this fake news is about? This kind of, and it's causing this sort of informatic uncertainty as to what's correct and what's not correct. So I don't want to get too much into the theory, but I'm thinking about it in those types of terms. You know, is this a post-fact era where we can't prove anything, nothing means anything? In a postmodern way, there's no meta-narrative to guide or to give any sort of overriding stability of any kind. Now, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think it's wrong. I think there's a different meta-narrative, and I think that meta-narrative is a kind of neoliberal ideology that is infusing information because of the way that the digital economy works. So I'm kind of looking at it in that way. It's kind of infused with these sort of like these ideologies. So I'm thinking about, I don't know, maybe can I call sort of a language in the age of algorithmic reproduction, can I call it subprime language? What's about to happen? Is there some kind of economic, you know, what are the consequences of this? That words are kind of being decoupled, or that so they don't really need to mean anything to actually create value. And the second conclusion, this is a favourite quote of mine, is from Audre Lorde. The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. So the way I like to think about this is that we know historically how important language is, sort of in a colonial way or in a sort of Foucauldian governance type way. We know how important control of the media is in a historical and propaganda type way. Yet we seem to just take for granted that the language that we're kind of that we're making flow through these digital systems to get whatever gains we can from the system, we're going to take it. We're not sort of maybe appreciating how much it's being stripped or how much is being added to it in the way. And so I like to think of that. You know, we can sit here debating sort of artificial intelligence and algocracy and technology and governance and all this kind of thing, but when it's written down and it becomes part of the wider corpus of words, it's added to. It's not pure. I know that's a problematic term in terms of language. There are sort of ulterior motives to the transference of these words through these digital spaces. That's my geography bit, by the way. So the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. So how can we critique this from within, basically? How can I stand here and print out these poems when I'm just using the Google tools to do it? So this is another sort of, you know, way I'm trying to sort of overtly do this critique and kind of accept that yes, I am using the tools, but I'm trying to turn them around, and I'm trying to sort of, you know, to make things visible and do good with them. So I think that was where I was going to finish. Yes, thank you again, Sarita Anna.
Thank you, very interesting. We have some time for questions.